seconds to from transmit to receive, from transmit to receive. That actually happens when you just key down and you send no audio. What it does is send null packets or idle packets. So it'll switch back and forth quickly. If you actually are doing audio, it may put 3 or 4 or 6 or 10 of these packets together in series before it switches back to receive.
I'm slowly getting more of the picture here, Eric. If the major modulation of DMR-like radios is 4 FSK, which is a purely angular modulation sound to it, that suggests that a Class C amplifier could do it, and the real difficulty is not linearity of the amplifier, it is integrity of the 28 millisecond of switching between transmit and receive. If I took a Mirage-like amplifier, and if by some magic I can allow it to switch between transmit and receive accurately within the 28 milliseconds and the 2 milliseconds of dead time and so on, if I could make the switching work right, but it's a Class C afterburner like Mirage, is that a possible viable approach to adding an afterburner? KE2EJ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Absolutely, but you have to get rid of the relay. The relay is just not going to cut it. The time it takes between energizing the coil and the contact closure, you're late. So, yeah. The circuit that I'm putting together is based around the mimic depth power block. And it just gets a really, really fast, good spin diode. I'm hoping that I can get the propagation delay down between detecting when the carrier is available, which will tell the rest of the amplifier to switch over and amplify. The rate of on and off has got to be good enough that the data passes without being chopped up.
Now, many of us use a Mirage-like amplifier, afterburner, by way of RF keying. And in the case of sideband, that has its slight disadvantages. If I'm willing to put a separate command cable to the amplifier, which has knowledge that the transmitter is about to transmit right now, and therefore I'm not RF keying, I'm, let's call it video keying or digital keying of the amplifier, would that get rid of some of those problems? Now, of course, you still can't use electromechanical. To move an electromechanical transmit receive relay takes something in the vicinity of 20 milliseconds, and you can blast it with great big voltages. You can probably bring it down to 12 milliseconds, nowhere near fast enough. So this has got to be purely electronic. So if I'm willing to put an extra cable to command that electronic switching, because it's using the knowledge directly from the transmitter, the real exciter, would that make this problem a little more easy, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Well, in essence, that's exactly what they do inside the radio. They use a chip called an OMAP chip, which is really an interesting chip made by TI. It's got a really powerful ARM processor, and it's good. There is actually a signal that says, we're going into transmit now. You're not going to get that out of these handy talking, although I'm not that familiar with the Motorola stuff, but I actually get that signal out of the defensive radio. I don't know if you can get out of this little portable radio. But the commercial amplifiers that are out there don't rely on any direct wiring, but yeah, sure, that would make it real simple. But as far as the diodes that I've selected, why should I go and try and do all this research when I can just simply look at the schematic for that radio that does it internally and use those diodes?
Of the schematics that you're familiar with, Eric, which now do the switching at the rate you want, up to what power level does this work? If I was doing this at 50 watts, I'm using a certain kind of diodes. If I want to use this at 500 watts, I'm a little worried that the diodes that simultaneously meet the survivability characteristics, insertion loss characteristics, switching speed characteristics, on-off ratio, and so on. If I wanted to build a 500-watt amplifier, I am guessing the switching network starts becoming a very rare animal. KE2EJ, KQRIW, the TechNet.
No, if I'm going to make 500 watts, I'm probably going to need two. There's a lot of neat tricks to do there. let's put it this way. The diodes that I'm familiar with will do 80-watt amplifiers. Typically, 40 50-watt amplifiers, but the power rating for doing actually more than 100 watts for about breaking down. You gotta remember, you gotta turn things off as much as you gotta turn them on.
That switching network that you're familiar with, Eric, that can switch 80 watts somewhat reliably, are we talking about a $50 module here? How expensive is that module that can switch at that rate? Over to you, Eric.
Now, the circuit that I'm working around is 8 diodes, not a module. It's 7 diodes, quite you know, set them up to the frequency that you're operating on, but to, you know, put that into the design of the amplifier. So, yeah. Actually, I'm changing it, just making it just 50 ohms in, 50 ohms out. I don't care.
Okay, we're finding more and more information about all this stuff. So, not quite obvious at first, is it? So it's Steve who asked the original question. Let's see if Steve has any final fills that he needs. And we're making some progress on DMR. KC2MTP, K2RIW, you got it, Steve.
Thank you very much, Dick. Yeah, all very interesting information, and I'm starting to learn. It'd be nice if they wrote DMR for dummies. Maybe someday. Back to you, Dick.
Eric, are you familiar with anybody's website that I could go to that would be the equivalent of DMR for dummies, K2EJ, K2RIW?
Well, I would start off by going to DMR.MARC, DMR.MOTOROLA.AMATEUR.RADIO.MARC. And there's a nice introduction to DMR. There's a nice white paper. It's the amateur radio's introduction to DMR. I think you find it on the first page. Yeah, that's a good place to start. If you're really looking for the technical information, Google is your friend.
And oh boy, is it. I wish some of the Google characteristics existed in the archives of ARRL. There are times when I know the exact name of the article, I know the exact name of the author, I know the exact call letters of the author, I know what issue it's in, and I go to the finder, I go to the archive index, so to speak, of ARRL, and it'll tell me it doesn't exist. So, whereas with Google, I can start giving it words for search. I can misspell the living daylights out of many of the words, and Google will come back and say, here's a different spelling of the word. Is that what you mean? Is that what you're looking for? And that at times is extremely helpful. I've started to use Google as a spell check because of that characteristic. Okay, we're going to move on. Looks like DMR is going to be the first 40 minutes of every TechNet from some time to come until we all...
Hey, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric.
The one really important thing that I neglected to say in all this stuff, including all of the digital mode, amateur radio's number one purpose is being able to communicate when the rest of the infrastructure falls apart. DMR, IRLP, Echolink, all those things rely on infrastructure to make them interoperable. So, don't throw away your plain old analog FM radio because
from what you just said, it makes it sound like DMR is not standalone. In other words, if I wanted to go through a repeater, even if the repeater has got backup power, or if I want to talk DMR radio to DMR radio, and I'm within line of sight range, I'm not quite sure what you're saying here, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW, what's going to fail in the worst?
Don't get me wrong, the DMR repeater can be standalone, provided, of course, the things that, for example, we had talked with the one local. That's a particular number. As long as every radio has that number to work. The way the DMR system is set up is that you have these channels in North America, worldwide, tri-state. So it gets you connectivity to other DMR repeaters. When the infrastructure way, all that goes away. So if you happen to be a person with a DMR radio, then all set up for the repeaters in New York, and you have all of those talk groups, except you don't have the local talk group, and you're out here, you might as well throw your radio in the garbage.
That's good to know. So for a dinosaur like me, who's hanging back and continuing to use analog equipment, both for my television receiver, as well as my ham radio equipment is saying, hang on to that data. Hang on to that hardware. It may become very useful. Okay, we're going to go over to our next questioner, which was Joe, to B2RYY. Sorry I didn't get back to you, Joe. And what would you like to talk about tonight? To B2RYY. K2RYW in the second half.
Well, I think you can put me on the list till next week because I wanted to do something a little later, but I'm going to get involved in. So put me on the list till next week. I'll pick it up then, okay? 2MMY.
Jim, don't give up so easily. We've got some time. What makes you not want to discuss your favorite subject tonight, Joe? And MMY, I'm going to pick you up after Joe. WA2RYY, tell us at least the subject matter, Joe. K2RYW.
Nah, I'm going to do it next week. I have more time to bounce it back and forth and discuss it. It's not really a highly technical subject, but, just requires maybe a little more time back and forth, that's all.
But as long as it's ham radio, and we've got some time, what's wrong with tonight? What will be different next week, Joe?
I'll be on the front of the list instead of the back of the list. How about that?
Okay. Mr. MMY, your signal was a little bit weak and quite often in the beginning got chopped off. So I know it's blank to MMY. Give me your full call and your name. And go right ahead, sir. K2RYW in the tech net. You were in there 20% of the time. I heard you say the word HT. So wherever you're located is not a good place. You've got to move that HT to a different place and try again. Mr. Blank MMY, K2RYW.
Can you see me better now because I'm on the mobile? Is that better?
Now that's hugely better. So please give us the full set of call letters and name and then proceed with your question or comment. K2RYW, the tech net.
Okay, hey, Dick, it's Ray. Can you do my candy? Knockers. My question's kind of dumb compared to the rest of them, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I ran a piece of coax as my transmission line from the radio out to the deck. Now what I want to do is use another piece of coax for the antenna. So I guess my question is, how does the radio wave know the difference between the transmission line and the actual piece of coax I'm using for the antenna? And could that be where you ground it? Or in that case, it's kind of like an NFED ZEP, right? So even in the case of an NFED ZEP, don't you have to ground the one of the ends, the ground end anyway, even though you technically don't need it as a dipole? That's part of the question. The other question was the first thing I asked, how does the radio wave know the difference between the coax that's being used for an antenna versus the transmission line? Back to you.
Now, this is a better question than you know about, Ray. One of the most confusing things for people first learning about radio is the word ground. The word ground has got about three different meanings. We ground our radios primarily for human safety. In other words, you want to make sure that nothing goes wrong with the wiring to the plug in the wall so that the 110-volt line, the hot side doesn't touch the chassis, and you touch the chassis and touch a radiator and you light up. So grounding your radio for human safety is the first reason. The second reason we ground our radios in many cases is to give it some degree of lightning protection. You would like that lightning bolt that hits near your radio that gives you EMP to your wiring of your transmission line, your antenna, and the rest of your radio equipment. You'd like that impulse to find itself to ground real fast. The third reason we do grounding in some cases is to make the radio transmitting antenna work correctly. Let me drop. And here's where the tremendous amount of confusion takes place, Ray. In the case of a quarter wave ground plane antenna, those ground plane radials, you call it the counterpoise, you can call it the other half of the dipole that's missing, because only the first quarter wave is there, the radiator. And so what impedance you get to ground on that ground plane radial system can make quite a bit of difference in the efficiency of the radio, of the antenna. So if I put a ground plane radio in my backyard on, say, 40 meters, and I only lay down three ground plane radios, I can easily have a situation where more than half my RF power is being coupled into Earth and not being radiated into space, because the impedance at the bottom of the antenna is 35 ohms. I would like the ground plane radio system to be a very small impedance compared to 35 ohms. I'd like it to be 3.5 ohms or less, and that may require 10 radios to do it right. If you're taking a station master-like antenna, where the actual antenna and its three little ground plane radios are high up in the air, great, a brand new set of rules starts coming into account. Let me drop it. That station master radio with those three little ground plane radios hanging down at a 45 degree angle every 120 degrees in azimuth. There's lots of RF energy on the end of those radios, but they're up in the air, nice and high, and that RF energy on the radios versus the RF energy that's on the main radiator in the center, that all works out very well. You start taking that station master and slowly lowering it closer and closer to the ground, the RF energy on the end of those three radiators starts coupling into the earth and starts wasting power. That gives you some impression of what's going on there. In the case of a thoroughly symmetric antenna, like a dipole that's being fed in the center, with a, either with twin lead or with coax and a good balance, the dipole itself has the right-hand side and the left-hand side acting as the counterpoise on the first half cycle, and everything reverses on the next half cycle. That is a thoroughly independent antenna. It doesn't give a damn about where ground of that system is. Let me drop it. Less of the signal it radiates, a certain percentage of that is going to bounce off the earth, and that's going to affect your vertical angle of peak radiation. But as far as the operation of the antenna is concerned, no ground is required. In the case of an end-fed ZEP antenna, where it's usually a half-wave radiator, and you're feeding it from the outer end, and that really is a kind of a dipole. In other words, the dipole, we all look at the diagrams of the dipole where it's fed in the center, and we think that there's no other place where it can be fed. If you're smart enough, you can feed that dipole center 10% off center, 50% off center, outer edge. As long as you calculate the proper impedance, the proper balancing action, the outer end of a dipole is a perfectly good way to feed it, and it's got a huge advantage when you do that. The disadvantage of feeding the outer end is you're feeding something like a 1,500 ohm impedance, maybe a 2,000 ohm impedance. That's a disadvantage that requires some kind of an impedance matching device. However, when you're feeding a 2,000 ohm impedance, whatever you use as the counterpoise, the ground by which you push that signal to the antenna from, as long as it's a fairly low impedance compared to 2,000 ohms, like 200 ohms, it's going to work. So therefore, you can take, let me drop it. You can take a half-wave long piece of wire, shoot it up in the air to your nearest tree with a bow and arrow, with a slingshot or whatever, and you're feeding the outer end of a half-wave dipole. A simple one single stake in the ground is more than enough grounding to give you less than one-tenth of the 2,000 ohm impedance, 200 ohm impedance. It's going to work like a charm. You don't need a great big ground plane radio system for an end-fed ZEP. In fact, there are people who don't use a grounding rod at all. In the case of an end-fed ZEP, there are people who have done nothing but feed the whole coax cable up to the antenna, didn't worry about the ground at all. A little bit of radiation is taking place from the outside shield of the transmission line going up there, but the thing works like a charm. So end-fed ZEPs have their own set of rules. When it comes to that signal coming from your radio, going down that transmission line to your deck, and then you join that transmission line to the other transmission line going to the antenna, as far as that radio signal is concerned, that's just one long transmission line where you've got some kind of an adapter in between, whether it be a female-to-female adapter, a T-connector, whatever, it'll work like a charm. So the word ground, a hell of a lot of good antennas work beautifully well with no ground at all. If an antenna always required a ground, then how in the world would the astronauts be transmitting signals from space? From the space shuttle, if you know what I mean. There's a lot more to the story, but the word ground can be very confusing, Ray. KC2MMY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, KC2MMY. That cleared some of it up, but what if I want to cut the second piece of coax a certain length, let's say for 80 meters or 40 meters, and I want that length because that's the resonant length that I want at a half wavelength. And so I have, let's say there's no baffling in between, so I have a transmission line running out to the deck, and then I have a specifically cut wavelength other piece of coax there. How would I force the wave to sit on the length that I want rather than treating the whole piece of line with a coupler in between as one long antenna, because that's not the length I want? Back to you.
What I think you're getting into here, Ray, is an old wives' tale. It's very popular, and some very intelligent, very well-experienced radio people fall into the trap. They think, and they have been led to believe by a whole lot of people saying so, that there is a magic length of transmission line that will make an antenna work well. 99% of the time, that is not true. I can take, if I've got a thoroughly balanced antenna, like a dipole, being fed with the right kind of a balance, the transmission line going to that dipole can be any length in the world that I desire. Eighth wave, quarter wave, half wave, full wave, 0.741 wavelength. The transmission line length does not matter most of the time. Now, if you have no balancing device at the antenna, and I'm taking a piece of raw coax cable, and it's a real dipole, and I take the center conductor of the coax cable, I feed it to the right-hand side of the dipole, I take the shield of the coax cable and feed it to the left-hand side of the dipole. Now, length of transmission line does matter. Let me drop. And the reason for that is a dipole wants to behave in a balanced manner. You may think you're feeding only the signal from the center conductor to the right-hand side. Well, you may think you're feeding 100 volts into that right-hand side of the dipole and 0 volts into the left-hand side because it's the shield of the coax cable. You may think you're doing that. You're putting 100 volts in the dipole. The way the dipole operates, he tries to force balance. He will try to force 50 volts on the right side and 50 volts on the left-hand side. You're putting only 100 volts on the right side. That dipole is going to rebalance things. That's just the way the dipole works. Now, all of a sudden, you've got 50 volts on the left-hand side going down the outside of the coax cable because you didn't use a balancing device on that coax. Now, because the outside shield of your coax cable is part of the radiator of that system, now as you change the length of that transmission line, you are changing the resonance of the dipole because it's got this other thing coupled to it in a radio manner, not just in a transmission line manner, in a radiation manner. Now, magic lengths of transmission line will behave differently in that case. However, you being smart enough to know that there should be a balancing device on the coax cable if it's feeding a balanced antenna like a dipole. Let me drop. And whether you put a real commercially made balancing, a Unideller or whatever brand name, at the center of the antenna, or whether you put in a poor man's balance by having four turns or five turns of coax cable near the dipole held together with black tape as a kind of RF choke, so that any signal that wants to flow down the outside of the coax cable gets choked off by the inductance of that cable, and therefore it doesn't flow down the rest. As long as you put even a poor man's balance or a real balance on that dipole, the length of the transmission line no longer matters. So all this magic jazz, you'd be amazed how many people think that there's a magic length. There was a person from ARL magazine who publishes a monthly journal, a monthly column, in which he believed that if there isn't a magic length of transmission line between his bird watt meter and the transmission line and the antenna, that without a magic length of that transmission line, he thought the bird watt meter would not read accurately. Lots of people believe that. You look at the instruction manual for bird watt meter, they do not. Wives' tale, and it's not really required, with that one exception I've just given you, Ray. KC2MMY.
Quick comment, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Dick, I haven't heard Ray mention a dipole antenna. What I think he's doing is
getting a piece of coax, as it is, on the end of a piece of coax from the transmitter. Now, without stripping that down and making a bazooka or something, I don't think he's going to transmit if that's what he's doing. But I may be mistaken, but I did not hear him mention an antenna specifically.
I thought he had a transmission. I thought he had a transmission line going out to the deck. I thought from the deck he has a transmission line going up to the antenna. And he wants to connect the two together. And he thinks there's a magic length of transmission line. Let's hear some more about what you're really doing, Ray. KT2MMY, K2RW in the TechNet.
Okay, John's kind of right in what I'm seeing. Remember, I'm not talking about a dipole. I'm talking about an infrared set. In theory, I guess. But what I'm doing is basically hooking two pieces of coax together, and I want one of them to act as an antenna. And I want the one that I'm connecting to on the outside, like, let's say, from the deck to the roof or something else. That's going to be my piece of cable. That's my antenna. And I want to make it a half a wavelength, let's say, for 40 meters. That's the distance from the deck to the top of the garage or whatever. All right, now, normally that would be an infrared tap, and it's cut for 40 meters, all right, but it's just a piece of cable hooked up to a piece of cable. So my question is, how do I negate that? How do I make the radio wave want to sit on the 40 half wavelength cut for 40 meters that I want, and have that piece of the cable act as the antenna? And I think the answer is to put a ballon in between, and then the wave will want to sit there. I think that's what you're kind of getting at. That's kind of my question. In other words, there's a piece of cable, and then there's another piece of cable, which I want to be an infrared tap. So how do I do that?
You could use a trombone.
You got to back up
about three steps here, Ray. You said you want the coax cable to be the antenna. Run that by again. Very few people use a piece of coax cable as the antenna. Tell me what you're trying to do. KC2MMY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is basically kind of a hypothetical, so I can understand this situation better. But there is a transmission line running to the deck, and then I want that transmission line to stop. That's the transmission line. Now I want to use another piece of coax. Theoretically, I want to use another piece of coax as the actual antenna part. And if I think you could follow what I'm saying. So there's two pieces of coax, and I know people don't use it, but you can. I could use just the center conductor, I guess, if I want. But what I'm saying is, how would I divide my transmission line from the antenna if I'm just using two pieces of coax, let's say, cut in half there? I don't know. Do you understand?
The words you've used are very ambiguous, Ray. There's something wrong. Maybe Eric heard it differently. Go ahead, Eric.
What I think he's trying to say is that, forget that even that he has a piece of cable that runs between the shack and the deck. Let's say he had the transmitter on the deck. He wants to use a piece of coax as an antenna. So what he really needs to do in order to do that, short bolt the center conductor and the outer part of the length of coax that's going to be his antenna. That would be like an NZZ, what he's thinking. Or, if he really wanted to be wise with that, and he's got an awful lot of coax, he could turn it into a coaxial antenna. Now, there's a lot of little tricks you could do, but I think really what he's doing is using that other piece of coax as the antenna one.
That's correct. Where would the ground be in that case? Or it's still not equal, and that's what I mean.
We've got to divide and conquer here. So forget about the radio in the shack and the transmission line coming from the shack. Assume you're standing on your deck, you've got a radio in your hand on the table, and you're about to set up an antenna. Tell me what kind of antenna are you going to use from your deck. Over to you, Ray, K2RIW.
Roger that. I want to use a piece of coax. Why can't I use a piece of coax for an antenna?
He wants to use a big round piece of wire. Forget the fact that it's coax.
Okay. Who whose design of antenna are you using? Yes, without a doubt, the coax cable is a very large diameter, quarter inch, half inch diameter piece of metallic structure. You can make that into an antenna. You can make that into a quarter wave ground plane, a half wave ground plane, an infrared, a 5/8 wave. You can make that into a beautiful set of antennas. I'm not quite sure why you want to use coax cable instead of wire. Describe the antenna that you're running from the deck. Let's just hear about the deck antenna. What kind of antenna is it? Is it a quarter wave, half wave? Is it an infrared zep? Will it have ground plane radios?
Is it really a stealth-type antenna? That's probably what he's going for.
Okay, is it a stealth antenna? Well, you want the antenna to be invisible. Tell us about the deck antenna, Ray, and whose design is it? And maybe it's an MMY design, KC2MMY, which is perfectly all right. KQIIW.
No, it's not anyone's design, and it's not stealth. It's just a... Let's say that's the only wire I have. I want to use a piece of coax because that's the only wire that I have. You know what I mean? Why can't I do that? That's going to be my antenna. And I want to make it an end-fed set, and I want to make it cut for a 40-meter half wavelength. That's it. That's that simple. And just as the other part of it, there happens to be a piece of coax as the transmission line that's going to that thing. So how does that work? Or can it work?
Step number one, as I see it, is you want the antenna to be able to work from the deck. For some reason, you've got an antenna being fed from your deck. And maybe you've decided that it's going to be an end-fed zip. A half wavelength of antenna fed from one end, a kind of a half-wave dipole fed from one end. And now, what you use as a local ground in that case does make some sense, some difference. There was a grounding rod near that deck that became the counterpoise. In other words, the cable coming out of the radio that's on the deck. The shield of it goes to the grounding rod that's near the deck, and the center conductor goes up to the half wave end-fed zep with an impedance matching device. Because the end-fed zep has an impedance something like 2,000 ohms. So let's first discuss the deck antenna, assuming the radio is on the table on the deck with you. Let's discuss that antenna first before we go any further. You've got to make that work before you add this extra transmission line, in my opinion. We have to divide and conquer here. So describe your deck antenna desire. KC2MMY, KQLIW in the deck net.
Okay, like I said, it's just very simple. I want to use a piece of coax as my piece of wire. Instead of a piece of wire, let's just say I don't have any wire. The thing I want to use for the antenna is a piece of coax. That's all it is. The tricky part is that we're getting into a transmission line that's attached to it, and I want to know how the radio wave knows the difference. And I think it has to do with if you have the bound in between. I don't know, are you getting that? It's very simple. The antenna front on the deck is just a piece of coax in place of a piece of wire.
Okay, let me back up here now, Ray. Let's assume that I give you a piece of wire. I give you as many hundred feet of RG, of 14-gauge household wire, without the rubber on it. I've given you the piece of wire. Tell me what your deck antenna will look like. How are you going to use that piece of wire if you had it? Over to you, Ray.
Okay, I'm going to use it as an end-fed zep. I'm going to cut it at a half a wavelength for 40 meters, and I'm going to run it from, you know, the railing of the deck to the top of the roof of the detached garage. And I'm going to cut it the length of a half a wavelength on 40. That's how I'm going to use it.
Dick, pick up K2UPS. You may have some recommendations.
We'll pick up Rich in a minute. Okay, that's the first step. You've now got a radiator half-wave long. One end is supported by the garage. The other end is supported by an insulator to the railing of the deck. You're feeding this end-fed zep at the outer edge. You are feeding a 2,000 ohm impedance. How are you going to adjust that 2,000 ohm impedance to keep your radio happy? Pretty soon we're going to go over to Rich where he's done things like this. He'll tell us how he did it. But what was the method by which you intended to match 2,000 ohms? Over to you, Ray. There's the step we've been skipping. KC2MMY, KQRIW.
Okay, Dick, I guess what I'm going to do, and I guess this is a question so I can understand. It's theoretical, kind of, so I guess what I'm going to do is use a 4-to-1 balun to drop 2,000 ohms down, you know what I mean, to 50 somehow, you know, or some kind of impedance matching device. But part of my question is, do you really have to do that? Let's say you drop a ground, because what am I going to do? Let's say that piece of coax I was going to feed, it has an outer shield ground. What do I do with that? Do I leave that hanging in the air, or do I drop that down to some kind of ground so that the length stays at a half wavelength at 40? I don't know. Do you see what I'm getting at?
It's missing an impedance matching network. It's never going to, doesn't quite understand that point.
Yeah, as we hear more and more of the story, Ray, it's becoming a little bit more clear. The 2,000 ohm impedance of a half-wave NFED ZIP compared to a 50-ohm transmitter, that is a 40-to-1 ratio. You don't match that with a half-wave coax balun. That's only a 4-to-1 ratio. You got another 10-to-1 to go. That's a 40-to-1 impedance error. You put 2,000 ohms on the end of a center conductor of a transmitter where the output connector is an SO239 and it's going to see 2,000 ohms instead of 50 ohms. That transmitter is going to be fairly unhappy. Now, Rich, with all of his portable operations of QRP, he's done this. Actually, he's going to tell us how he did it. K2, Uncle Papa Sierra, probably in Ohio, heading for home. K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
K2UPS, well, I'm out in Pennsylvania right now, Dick, just in New Stanton, transition from I-76 up onto I-70, eastbound, heading back to New York. Yeah, Ray, he's just not comprehending the fact that you can't take a 50-ohm feed line and plug it into a 1,500 or 2,000-ohm antenna and expect it to work. There's got to be something in there, like Eric, and you're trying to get through to him, but he just doesn't seem to be grasping that piece of it. He hasn't had his aha moment yet with that. I use the NFED antenna 90% of the time when I'm operating portable, and I use a 9-to-1 un-in because it's going unmatched, or I should be unbalanced coax feed to an unbalanced single wire antenna. It's not a balun, it's an un-in. You might get away with a 4-to-1 depending on the length you make it, what frequencies you want. I use a 9-to-1 and I still need an automatic antenna tuner, but it works just fine. I also do not run any sort of ground or counterpoise because I'm running usually, typically, at least 25 feet of coax, so the shield on the coax acts like the counterpoise that the antenna wants to see, and I'm running at QRP level, so it doesn't really create issues for me. You can use the coax to transmit, to radiate, but you're going to want to do, like Eric said also, short the shield and the center conductor together. But now you got a much thicker, heavier piece of material to hang suspended in the air. Just go with a thin piece of wire. You're not going to get any performance degradation, and it'll be a lot easier to suspend a piece of wire than more coax back then.
Berkeley program might help too, Dick.
That's exactly where I'm going. We have to say it a few times, Ray, to make a little more sense out of this. NFED ZEP, beautiful Anton. ZEP means Zeppelin. That's where it originally came from. In the old days, a guy would hang a long piece of wire out of the back end of a dirigible, a blimp, a Zeppelin, and he feeds the end of that with an impedance matching device. And he used the rest of the Zeppelin, which is some crazy wavelength, he doesn't care, as the counterpoise. The good news of an NFED ZEP, 1,500 ohm, 2,000 ohm impedance antenna, is that what you use as ground becomes very non-critical. You can get away with murder on that antenna, but you gotta have an impedance match. If you assume that your piece of wire, half wavelength long at 40 meters, in your case, is half wavelength long, if you assume it's going to be 1,500 to 2,000 ohm of impedance, it will be. If you then go to the Berkeley program, you simply Google the word Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, plus impedance match. You Google those two words, and you come up with this Berkeley program, where Berkeley will ask you, hey Ray, what is the impedance of your antenna? And they want to know the resistive component and the reactive component. Because it's a half wavelength and resonant, the reactive component is 0 ohms. Your resistive component, you can plug in 1,500 or 2,000, close enough. That's the first question they ask you. The second question is, let me drop. The second question is, Berkeley will say, what's the impedance of your signal generator, your source? And you're going to write down 50 ohms for the resistive component and 0 ohms again from the reactive component. So now, and the third question that Berkeley's going to ask you is, what frequency are you operating at? And you're going to say 7,100 kilohertz or 7.1 megahertz, if you know what I mean. So you give Berkeley impedance of the antenna, the impedance of the transmitter, and the frequency, and you press go, and in a fraction of a second, Berkeley gives you 16 answers. An L network, an upside down network, a T network, a pi network, an LT pi. You choose the one that you like. Berkeley tells you the exact value. It'll tell you that this has got to be a 7 microhenry inductor and a 150 picofarad capacitor. And then you go to the radio amateur's handbook, you find out how to wind a 7 microhenry coil and how to homebrew a 100 picofarad capacitor if that's what you need, or you pick it out of your junk box. But there's got to be an impedance matching device there. You're starting off with a 40 to 1 error, 2,000 ohm antenna, 50 ohm impedance. No antenna tuner, within reason, can tolerate a 40 to 1 standing wave ratio. 4 to 1, yes. 40 to 1, forget it. So you're going to put an impedance matching device there, an L and a C if you choose an L network, the simplest. It'll work like a charm. You can homebrew it. Once you've got that impedance matching device, what you use as ground after that is not very important. You're getting away with murder because you're feeding such a high impedance. That's what they did with a Zeppelin. I know you're going to have to hear this a couple of times to make some sense out of it, right? And by the way, lots of guys are in the exact same boat you're in asking this question. KC2MMY, it is a good question, right? K2RIW, the tech net.
Okay, K2RIW from K2MMY in the tech. I do understand the process. I'm asking the question on purpose because I want to get to a key factor, okay, about my understanding of the antennas. And I have a lot of different parts and pieces that I do understand. But you basically answered the question in the light of you need the balancing device. That's what's going to make the difference between the cutoff point of the transmission line and the beginning point of the end fed set. It's the balancing device. That's the answer I was looking for. So you did answer the question, which is great. And so I guess the next just little part of the question is what is typically used? I don't want to build my own LC network to do it. So what's typically used? I can use a Richardson. I can use a 9-to-1 un-un. So is that typically something I could easily pick that up? Or what do people use who do end fed sets? Do they make their own balancing devices, or do they just have an un-un laying around?
I'm about to pass it over to Rich. He's going to tell us the brand name, the dollars, where he bought is unknown. His 9-to-1 device, it happens to be a balancing device, and his balancing device happens to include impedance match. So impedance matching and balancing are slightly different, and you can combine them. The highest need in this case is impedance matching. His particular device, called Onion, happens to have a 9-to-1 impedance match, where he needs a 40-to-1. That brings it down to about a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio that his antenna tuner can then handle. So he's doing the impedance matching in two steps. The Onion with the 9-to-1 is the first step, and his antenna tuner is the second step. So that Onion that you used, Rich, what brand name, how many dollars, where did you buy it, and why don't we all have one? K2, Uncle Papa Sierra. Thank you. K2RIW, the deck net. You got it, Rich.
Okay, deck K2UPS, mobile returning. Well, I built one. I built more than one using plans that I got off the internet. And there's a group, the Emergency Amateur Radio Club of Hawaii, or URCH, as a lot of people call it. For years, they sold it as well. Now I believe they just had the plans up. But it's very simple to build. There's more than one diagram. If you Google, 9-to-1 on it, or 9-to-1 balance, or whatever you want to call it, you'll find a lot of different plans. It was a three-wire wraparound. I forget the exact number of turns offhand, but it's around a toroid coil. very simple to do. Toughest part is just finding the toroid, but you can find those online as well. If you do not want to make your own, there are several companies out there. Balon Designs happens to be one. They make really good products. I bought their smaller QRP versions of it. They work great, but it's not difficult to make your own. The only thing inside this thing is it has an SO239 connector, and the wire comes out. There's two other wires in there. They get wrapped around a toroid a bunch of times, and output on the other side to a counterpoise and the center conductor. Price-wise, probably about maybe $30 to $60, depending on the power range you're looking at. You can build them yourself for probably under $20, but the plans are all online. Back to net.
To your comment.
Bravo Delta, with a comment.
Okay, two guys with a comment. The first guy, please give me your full call letters and your name. It sounds like Kim. Go ahead.
Victor, this is Kilo Delta 2 Alpha Victor Uniform, Tim, and I've got comment.
Go right ahead with the comment, Tim.
Actually, the 921 RON, I've built that before. Built it with T200-2. Uses two material, the toro material. And it's really simple to build. And I've used around it with roughly 50 watt maximum, and I got bitten by the RF, so some sort of a counterpoise is required, and that's the one thing to you know, to be careful with if you play with the 921. You know, there must be a RF ground somewhere, and I'm feeding the almost a half wave NSAT antenna of 40 meters using the 921, and it works pretty well, but it's really important to have some sort of, you know, counterpoise with that device. So, back to the net.
22QIQ in cabin. QIQ is the third person making comment. Tim, when you're feeding an impedance that high, sometimes just the railing of a balcony or the metal railing of a deck could be enough of a counterpoise. Is that what you use for a counterpoise, Tim? And roughly how much did you pay for that toroid when you built your own balun? TD2AVU, T2LAW, the TechNet.
I use the grounding rod in my backyard as a counterpoise, and efficiency seems good, and the length of the connection between my radio to the grounding rod is roughly around, let's say, 10 feet. I guess that's enough for a 921 on. And let me see the material, T200-2, checking the price on eBay, toroid. $7 plus 2.7, I mean, almost $3 shipping, so $10 for the toroid core. And, you know, you can use PVC insulated wire for that, not stranded, but a solid core. Or if you are going to run a little power, you can use the Teflon insulated wire, which is a little bit more. Or you can use the RG, what is that, RG 136, I think, 136, the Teflon insulated center conductor. You can use that for winding balun, but T200 means 2 inches outside diameter, so if you're running a, you can, you know, also use a larger one, like, you know, T350-2, which is 3.5 inch outside diameter. It works pretty well. Back to you, Dick, K2RW, KD2AVU.
Quick message, Dick. Where did you get the design for that, Jim.
Yeah, give me a minute. Run a quick Google search. Type in 929 and it will show up a bunch of construction plans on Google. I got my design from Mexico Zero United Kingdom Delta M0 UKD website. 921 magnetic low wire balance. Over.
Very good information, Tim. Sounds like John's got a point of order. KC2WGB, K2RW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB, Dick, just someone to pick up on Echolink. KC2CMQ has a question about, I guess you give us some Smith chart guidance. We just added out to the list.
Very fine, he's on the list. Okay, Tim was the first guy who signed in. There was a second person who signed in with information, and then Glenn in that order. Who was the second person?
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta, John.
Go right ahead, John.
Thank you very much. Good evening, Dick and the TechNet. K2RW from Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta. I think some parts of Rick aren't really being addressed in this discussion, and these are some of my suggestions. He wants to build an end-fed ZEP. Usually these types of antennas are fed to a length of quarter-wave balanced line. And I want a good example of an end-fed ZEP that can be constructed, fed, without balloning and impedance match devices. You just need to look at a big bowl design. It's really just an end-fed ZEP. The only difference is that the transmission and the radio both usually same plane, usually both vertical. What Rick wants to do is he wants to hang the antenna horizontal and probably have a vertical transmission coming down from that horizontal run sit on one end. So I would use quarter wavelength of balanced line. And if you the bottom end of the quarter wave balanced line, you could probably find a tap point on that line where you get a 50 ohm impedance. I think another part of Ray's question was dealing with using coax as a radio versus using coax as a transmission line, and has the RF noted difference between the two conditions. And I think the answer to that relates to how the is behaving, whether it's behaving in a traveling wave manner, which is the way it would be on the transmission line, versus a stick wave condition, which is what it would be on the radio element itself. So there's the way it's being fed, the RF characteristics, the common mode characteristics. So I think that's something that he's trying to get to and trying to get a grasp on. K2RIW on the technical net from KD2BD.
Okay, John, lots of good information there. Your audio is a little bit on the loud side and the repeater drops out as you hit loud audio pieces. Good, I'll go to know that one. I thank you for that information. Now, Glenn has built, I think, an awful lot of end-fed ZEP antennas, particularly in Florida. Let's see how you solve the problem, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, two first comments, Dick. One was the T200 material. That's made by a company called, it's a powdered iron material. And the company, the American Magnetics Company that used to make it, which is now, I think, AMM, it's powdered iron. Powdered iron's got a whole bunch of reasons why you don't want to use it with RF. One is it has an aging problem where the impedance of it changes over time. It'll arc. It breaks down the binder. A lot of reasons not to use T200 for balance and for RF transformers. A better choice would be a ferrite material, something around 200 perm, just pure ferrite. No nickel metal iron, no iron at all if you can. Just try to stick to pure ferrite. KC2QIQ, let me let it drop.
Do suggest a brand name and Dobbins where we can get the ferrite grid, Eric. Anyway, Glenn.
The geometry that he mentioned before, which is about a 2-inch diameter and having roughly about a quarter inch of side, so in other words, quarter inch by quarter inch. 4-inch cross-sectional area is probably a good starting place for the core geometry. Magnetic ink is a great choice for ferrite, and the name of it is usually P material. There's another company called Ferrite. Ferrite also makes ferrite material, F-A-I-R-R-I-T-E, and they also have a 77 material, which is also very good deck.
Okay, some other doctored information. Thank you, Glenn. Let's see if Ray needs any fill on any of this. KC2MMY, K2RIW, the check man.
That was part one. Can I go ahead with part two?
Go ahead with part two.
My general experience with half-wave antennas, in other words, if you have anything that's cut close to half-wave, especially like in 40 meters or 80 meters, even 18, 20, most of those bands, if you have something cut to approximately half-wavelength, the prime torsion ratio to put on there, and it will pretty much cover most of these bands, is basically a 6-to-1 voltage or a voltage turns ratio. So in other words, you basically have 60 turns, and where the first 10 turns basically attached to the transmitter, and then you extend, in other words, you tap off the 10th turn, and you continue another 50 turns up to the end, and the end is where you connect your NFED antenna. So now you're still going to need an antenna tuner on the back of the radio, but usually a 36-to-1 impedance ratio or 6-to-1 voltage ratio usually makes a very, very good choice for tuning an NFED antenna with a very, very minor touch-up on the VSWR. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Thank you, Glenn. Remember when I estimated that the NFED ZEP could be as high as 2,000 ohms compared to a 50-ohm transmitter? That's a 40-to-1 impedance ratio. My Glenn recommending a 6-to-1 turns ratio. The crazy thing about transformers is the turns ratio squared becomes the impedance ratio. So 6-to-1 squared is 36, close enough to 40-to-1. Now you're well inside the range where your antenna tuner can do it. So the 6-to-1 turns ratio is the Glenn's version of the onion, so to speak, that Rich was talking about earlier. Let's see if Ray needs any further fills on this. KC2MMY, K2RIW, the tech net. You've got it, Ray.
Okay, Dick, this is great. I got everybody jumping. We got a lot of good information, and I really am understanding a lot. And like I said, I understood most of it before, but I'm looking for some specific key points. And I guess so my last part of the question would be with the gentleman that used the grounds, because he got some feedback and he got a little shock going on there. Is it required that the ground have to be at the beginning of the ZEP, where you feed it? Or can that ground be anywhere along the transmission line or what have you? And that would be it. Thank you.
It's my guess that the ground should be as close to the beginning point of the ZEP as you can get. But a 10-foot length to ground is a little longer than desirable, but it can be used. The nice thing about this toroid transformer we described is it really has the equivalent of a primary and a secondary winding. It's got isolation. It's simultaneously the beams match and a balancing device. So therefore, if you've got 10 feet of wire between your point of feeding and ground, that's the equivalent of feeding your NFED ZEP dipole a little bit off of one end. Remember I told you, if you're smart enough, you can feed a dipole anywhere you want, from the center to the outer end, and you can back off from the outer end by 10 feet if you want to. And the balancing device, this toroid transformer, takes care of that. So you're just feeding a little bit from one end, and that's a minor detail. But once you get the impedance ratio, the 6-to-1 turns ratio, in the right ballpark, then your antenna tuner can easily take over. And part of what Tim was talking about with the arcing and where he got some shock with his fingers is the fact that, yes, when you've got a 2,000 ohm impedance being fed, let's say, 100 watts of power, we can easily calculate what the voltage is there. It's 1,000 or 2,000 volts. And although it's RF energy, and it's not going to give you an electrical shock per se, it still has the ability of giving you an RF burn. It's not dangerous, it's darn uncomfortable, and so be a little bit careful about insulation
and where you put your fingers. Let's see if you have any further requests on all this array. KC2MMY, K2RAW in the deck.
Clarification, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, I believe what...